Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Is America at risk of losing its position as a global superpower? What's at stake for the United States in East Asia? What's at stake for the rest of the world? And how does it stand to impact us in South Dakota? Our next guest is the author of a new book. It's called Asia's Reckoning, China, Japan, and the Fate of U.S. Power in the Pacific Century. Richard McGregor is a journalist with extensive experience in reporting from East Asia and Washington. He's written for Foreign Policy and the International Herald Tribune, among other major news outlets. He's also author of the acclaimed book, The Party. He joins us now to talk about the power triangle between the U.S., China, and Japan. Richard McGregor, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
You say East Asia is entering a new era of instability and potential conflict. What are some of those warning signs?
Well, I guess there's many warning signs. I mean, if you think about the big picture, you know, East Asia since the end of the war, North Korea aside, has been an absolutely an economic miracle on many levels. But it's been a political failure if you think about it. You know, the Korean Civil War has never been solved. China-Taiwan, the Chinese Civil War has never been solved. Japan and China, which are the region's two giants, their relations are worse than they've been for decades. And I think one of the reasons why countries could get on with focusing on their economies and not too much worry about these large political fault lines is because the U.S. kept the peace. The U.S. was the benign imperial power in East Asia. And I think the big variable, the big reason why that's coming to an end is the rise of China. China considered itself to be the rightful dominant power in Asia. And I think over time, China wants to push the U.S. out. But of course, U.S. allies like Japan, South Korea, Singapore, Australia don't want that to happen. So I think we're entering an entirely new era now.
The rise of China, do you mean economically, from a military standpoint, from a political standpoint, all of the above?
All of the above. The economy is the most important one. China didn't spend too much on its military when it first started to develop its economy from the late 70s onwards. But since the early 90s, the budget's gone up 17% a year on average. China's been very smart at leveraging its new power politically. It does that a number of ways. Most countries in Asia, their biggest trading partner by a long shot is China. That gives China enormous leverage. They do now have a formidable military which can challenge the U.S. in places like the South China Sea. They can challenge Japan in the East China Sea. They're sort of semi-colonizing the hinterland to the west, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and places like that. It's very hard, unless you live there, just to realize how China's influence just permeates almost all levels of interactions, both economically and politically, throughout Asia these days. It's very hard to keep up, and I think the U.S. is struggling.
What's driving it, and this is kind of a broad question, but philosophically, is there a drive to expand beyond Asia? Is there an imperialism to it?
No, it depends how you define imperialism, really. But I do think that, the Chinese have a sense of their place in Asia. You can call it a chip on the shoulder or whatever you think. They feel there's a narrative of the national humiliation they suffered from the mid-19th century onwards when, the British took bits of their country, the Japanese took large bits, the Germans did, the Russians did. And now they feel they've finally regained their self-respect, they've regained their power, they've regained what I guess they would regard as their rightful place as the great power of Asia. Now, there's a big debate about, what that means. Does China want to just have a peaceful region, or do they want everybody to sort of pay obeisance to them? But I think many of the countries, respect China greatly, but they don't trust it, and that's a real problem.
That's, I guess, the heart of my question is, does China want a peaceful region, or do they want something else?
Yeah, I think they do want a peaceful region. They particularly... you know, that's been the great benefit that the U.S. Has provided, the U.S. military presence. It sounds like has a whiff of old-fashioned imperialism of itself, and you can argue it is, but the U.S. Military deployments in Asia have just been immensely valuable for all those countries. Could China do what the U.S. Has done in Asia? I'm not so sure, frankly, because of that lack of trust that I talked about. China's not a colonial power. They don't, you know, we can talk about where its boundaries are, whether it is, in fact, becoming an imperial power in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, where there's lots of territorial disputes and the like. But I also think the fact that China is not a democracy, the system of government is not transparent, makes it a very different sort of animal than the U.S., which I think is a trusted power, by and large, in East Asia, whereas China is not.
Let's talk about the relationship between China and Japan, and that goes back way before World War II, but you talked a little bit about national humiliation, and the book covers something called the History Wars. Give us a little idea, a taste of what's between these countries over the centuries, really.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody, any Americans who've just witnessed what happened in Charlottesville, you know, everybody understands that it takes a long time for history to be washed out of politics, if it ever is. In Japan and China, you've got that same kind of trend on steroids, I think. You've got the two big Asian powers, they're geopolitical rivals. They've never really got on very well for an extended period of time. Their elites don't mix with each other and the like. One has inevitably been on top and the other sort of the junior partner. In other words, they've always struggled to treat each other as equals. And then, of course, the Japanese invasion and the war in the 30s and 40s, when the Japanese were very brutal colonizers in Manchuria. They did conduct massacres and the like. And in some respects, the Chinese not only have not forgotten that, they've made sure they haven't forgotten about it, because for the ruling Communist Party in China, if they want a rallying point, if they want to rally the masses, there's no better way to do that than to give Japan, the sort of traditional enemy, a good kicking. And it's become this sort of plaything in domestic politics in both countries, and that's very difficult to unwind.
So much depends on the American president, President Trump, now, and I'm thinking about his campaign, some of the things he said about trade with China. What does he bring to the table that shifts this conversation between these three nations?
Well, there's no doubt that President Trump does represent a big shift in attitudes in Washington. And it may be that he reflects, and this is why he won the election, the views of many people outside of Washington in the rest of the U.S. I mean, you can remember, for example, that he showed great disdain for the U.S. role in Asia during the election campaign. He said, well, Japan, why do we protect them? They're not going to fight alongside us. I don't care if they get nuclear weapons. They can fend for themselves. He said much the same about South Korea. Like many things Mr. Trump says, that would never have been uttered in polite company in Washington before. The other issue, and this is, I think, partly driving the fact of his view that in some respects the U.S. is being ripped off, is the trade issue, because, you know, the U.S., part of the value of the U.S. to the region is not only did they provide security goods, they also, in the case of Japan in particular, opened their market to Japanese goods, so Japan would become a strong, reliable ally. And obviously that affected the U.S. economy. So Mr. Trump, not only saying all these things, but then winning the election and, you know, continuing on and off to express similar views, is an absolute game changer in East Asia.
Not necessarily in a positive way? In a positive way? Too early to tell?
It's too early to tell. Mr. Trump didn't create the North Korea problem. He inherited that.
Right.
There are issues on trade, particularly with China. which I don't think he's handled well so far, but there are genuine complaints to be had about, you know, technology transfer and theft of intellectual property and the like. So he's on to some issues, and which are quite, you know, quite fair enough for him to take up. I think the problem is his manner in doing so. You know, anything a U.S. president says is taken very seriously and has an immediate impact overseas, particularly in Asia and these countries which are, you know, allies of the U.S. And take North Korea, for example. You know, he called Kim Jong-un a smart cookie. One stage, he said the problem with North Korea's nuclear weapons could be solved over a burger in the White House. A little while later, he talked about fire and fury, you know, giving the sense that military action could be in the winds. You know, then just when he needed to marshal South Korea's support against North Korea, he started tweeting about getting rid of the South Korea free trade agreement. You know, it's kind of all over the shop, and that doesn't send a consistent signal to American allies, nor to China, and it's not particularly strategic, because this is not something that's going to be solved overnight with a single tweet.
You're just tuning in. My guest is author and journalist Richard McGregor. The book we're talking about, Asia's Reckoning, it's available in bookstores this week. And I'm wondering about tensions between China and Japan and our relationship with Tokyo right now. How does President Trump handle that relationship? Because President Obama was not always comfortable with the way those conversations were always going. It's a difficult partnership at best.
It has been a difficult partnership, but it's a resilient one. You know, you think about it. You know, the U.S. Beat Japan in a war. No, nobody likes to lose a war. But I think in some respects, Obama did have problems with the Japanese and with Abe, but I think in some respects, the U.S.-Japan relationship now is closer than it has been for 70 years. It's certainly closer militarily, and that's basically because Japan needs the U.S. to balance China. Japan can't handle China on its own. And so it's absolutely fixed on getting the U.S. relationship right. I mean, it's one reason why the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was, I think, the first world leader to visit Mr. Trump after his election at Trump Tower, gave him a nice gift, a lovely golf club, a driver, and has been stayed on Mr. Trump's tail ever since then. Talks to him regularly on the phone, tries to work very closely with him, because that's the Japanese aim, is to stick close to the U.S. and try and get the best out of Mr. Trump that they can.
Does the U.S. need Japan?
Well, if the U.S. wants to stay in Asia, it does need Japan. I think a lot of Americans probably, you know, maybe I'm being presumptuous in saying this, but probably don't realize, you know, that Japan is actually America's most important bilateral military ally. America's biggest naval base overseas is in Japan, south of Tokyo, an immensely valuable and productive port, obviously having problems recently with a number of accidents in the Pacific theater. But if America wants to stay a global superpower, wants to stand its ground in Asia, Japan is indispensable. It's still powerful. It's still the third biggest economy in the world. China's the second. The U.S. is the first. So there's a lot at stake. And Japan, people have kind of forgotten about it, but it's very important.
We've got about a minute left, and I'm wondering, unprecedented access to archives in U.S. and Asia. You've reported on East Asia for decades. I'm wondering what's new in this book that you found and had access to that really, provided the depth that you weren't able to get at before?
Well, I think pat myself on the back, I think I did get access to archives that people hadn't accessed before, or certainly in English, or got it in Japanese and Chinese and translated it into English. I think I have a depth of the conversations between the top leaders, which haven't been published before in some instances. And I think I hope I have managed to give a balanced perspective from three ways. In other words, let everybody speak for themselves and not take sides. I mean, readers might read the book and come up with a viewpoint, which I certainly would myself, but I've tried to give a fair representation of everybody's position, and I've done that by talking to all three sides. You know, I didn't sit in Washington to listen to China experts talk about China. I've lived right. in China, I've lived in Japan, so I think I've given a good, fair balance of views.
Richard McGregor, it's a fascinating book. I'm in the middle of it right now. So much to think about and process. Hopefully you'll join us again in the future. We appreciate your time today.
Anytime. I much appreciate it. Thank you.
And the book is called Asia's Reckoning, China, Japan, and the Fate of U.S. Power in the Pacific Century.